I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 12th of October. Mondays at 1 means all things political, and we'll meet our guest in just one moment. First, though, we do want to thank all of you who contributed during our wonderful fall membership drive. We had more than 6,000 listeners pledging, including 2,000 sustaining pledges and 1,700 brand new members to WPR. You donated more than $775,000 to fund the Wisconsin Public Radio programs that are so important to you. And seriously, we thank you very, very much. All things political coming up now, and our guest is Goldie Taylor. Goldie has been with us before. She's an editor-at-large for the Daily Beast. She's been a journalist for 25 years now, an award-winning journalist and opinion writer, and she served as political analyst and on-air contributor at MSNBC, where she focused primarily on public policy issues. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the debate on Wednesday. The Democrats will finally have a debate tomorrow. It's going to be in Las Vegas. And there are three people who will be on the stage, maybe four, if Joe Biden shows up. They have a special podium for him in case he arrives. But actually, it'd probably be smart for him to enter the race that way, wouldn't it? But nobody knows whether or not he'll be there. We've heard a lot about Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, but there are three other people, Martin O'Malley, James Webb, and Lincoln Chafee, who will also be on the stage tomorrow. So we'll talk about the debate styles of all of these people. And as Carly Fiorina really broke out from the second-tier ranks during the first Republican debate, do you anticipate, does our guest anticipate, that any of the three that we haven't heard very much about will also break out? Frank Bruni asked an interesting question in yesterday's piece, asking, and we ask you this too, do you believe that the Republican frontrunners, Donald Trump or Ben Carson or Carly Fiorina, could become the Republican nominee? Is that out of the question, or do you think it's a likelihood? Where is the money coming from for the presidential race? Interesting piece yesterday that looked at 158 families donating a real huge amount of money. You know that Republicans are begging Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan to become the Speaker of the House. Why have they chosen him? Will he say yes? He's not very crazy about it, but does he need to for the unity of the Republican Party? Former staffer on the House Benghazi Committee saying the investigation was a partisan attack on Hillary Clinton. We will talk about that. And we will look at the bombings in Turkey over the weekend, horrific bombings, and the president saying on 60 Minutes yesterday that he's giving up on training and arming a Syrian rebel force because there were all kinds of complications in getting people to sign up for that. Instead, we will work with established rebel groups. I don't know what the way is out of that morass, but we'll ask our guest that as well. So, to join the conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page, we love to get your messages, is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Goldie Taylor, thanks very much for being with us again. Hi.
Thank you for having me. Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, nice to have you here. So I was looking at the picture CNN released, the podium order. And, you know, the race is so much centered on Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders that we have these three other gentlemen, and maybe Joe Biden, who will also be on the stage tomorrow. And it's amazing to me, Goldie, we've heard almost nothing about them.
I think part of that is, you know, whether or not their campaigns have captured enough traction that the major networks are going to say a whole lot about them, and you can see that even on the Republican side of the table, that when you've got someone polling at 0 to 4%, then you're going to get, you know, sort of less what they called earned media. And so these things tend to feed on themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Better you do, the more coverage you get, the better you do, and on and on and on.
Right.
You know, we've seen even Bernie Sanders has climbed in the polls over recent months. And part of that is, you know, he's doing better, crowds are turning out, more media is paying attention, and thus he's doing better, and so it's sort of this huge cycle. And so I think that as candidates begin to rise and capture more attention, you're going to see, you know, cameras sort of following them and this sort of cycle continuing. So I'm not at all surprised that some of the other candidates and lesser-known candidates are not being focused on as much. And you also have to understand, and you do, of course, this being public radio, that network cable television is a business. And they are going to play up those candidates that they think are going to draw them the biggest ratings. You saw in the last promo for the presidential debate that they kept running, you know, Donald Trump's voice, because they knew that as erratic and irrational as Donald Trump can be, he brings viewers.
Yeah.
And so they led with his voice, and in these CNN promos, you're seeing them lead with Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders' voices.
And then a lot of the cable networks also played all of Trump's speeches to everybody. It's been like solid Donald Trump forever.
Solid wall-to-wall Donald Trump. You're seeing less of it now. There used to be a time when all three of the cable news networks, and sometimes not Fox, but mostly CNN and MSNBC, would play Donald Trump every town hall meeting, every time he took to a podium. They would play it live. And I've got to tell you that the ratings during that time were through the roof. But then people got tired.
Right.
People sort of understood that we were being, I guess as they call it on the internet, clickbaited.
Mm-hmm.
and so they stopped playing him live quite so often. Every once in a while they kind of jump into something and then back out. You know, and you can probably see it being streamed on the web, but you don't see this wall-to-wall coverage that you used to see, I think, frankly, because they heard from their viewers and that the viewers had had enough.
Yeah, enough is enough. Now, if I were Joe Biden and I were entering this race, I would show up tomorrow night and surprise everybody.
Oh, if I were Joe Biden, I'd come in on a jetpack tomorrow night. But understanding what I do about this vice president, he believes in debate prep. Unlike some of the other, you know, front runners on the GOP side, seemingly, you know, Donald Trump doesn't really believe in debate prep. He said that out loud. But Joe Biden does. And there has been no debate team assembled, no messaging team assembled, mm-hmm. no preparation. He's not one, even though he sounds like he's winging it all the time. There's not a chance in the world he's going to show up without appropriate preparation for tomorrow night's debate, especially with Hillary Clinton standing on one side or the other of him.
So you don't imagine he's going to be there tomorrow?
I don't imagine that he'll be on that podium tomorrow.
The Times had an interesting piece yesterday, I'm sure you saw, and let's start with Hillary Clinton, who you would imagine would be very, very focused on preparing for this debate. And there was a story about her high school, and she was asked to debate the side, even though she was a Goldwater supporter in those years, to debate from the viewpoint of Lyndon Johnson. And she just prepared the heck out of that debate and did a whale of a job. She'll know her figures and facts tomorrow.
She will absolutely know her figures and facts tomorrow, but I will tell you that the best I've ever heard from Hillary Clinton is when she didn't have her figures and facts and she just spoke from, you know, from her heart.
Mm-hmm.
And she's only done that a couple of times in her career.
Yeah.
You know, I can count them on my hand, probably more than four,
mm-hmm.
Where she's stood up without notes, no prepared speech, no prepared talking points, and just spoke on a given issue. I think this recent town hall she did, I believe there was the parent of a student from Sandy Hook?
From Newtown? Mm-hmm. Yes.
And she, the words that she gave for that parent were not prepared.
Yes.
They were some of the most heartfelt that I had
ever heard.
She was breaking up. That's the Hillary Clinton that people have been looking for.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the one she keeps most cloaked, and that one won't be present tomorrow night.
Yeah, with all of the money that you spend on advisors, wouldn't you think, Goldie, that somebody would tell her, you've got to do this in a way that's believable. Don't break into this heartfelt Hillary Clinton all the time, but you've got to show more of that, and you wonder why she doesn't.
You know, colleagues and I were having just that conversation here in the newsroom here at the Daily Beast the other day, and our suspicion, collective suspicion, was that she's a bit uncomfortable. You know, Bill Clinton brought new meaning to being comfortable in your own skin.
Absolutely.
And that does not seem to be the case for Hillary Clinton, that she does believe in preparation, because she still, although has this, you know, great, great well of experience, arguably more experience than anyone else in the race on either side of the aisle, she still has this reservation. I call it imposter syndrome, that someday or other they're going to figure out that maybe you shouldn't be here.
Hmm.
When truly those are the people who are, you know, most qualified to be present. And so I think she does tend to overprepare as a compensator when I think she ought to just let it fly.
Mm-hmm. And Bernie, who's really been doing very well in the polls, this same piece I was referencing looked at his debating style. Bernie has a tendency to give very, very long speeches. He believes passionately about certain issues, and he's moved other people to also address those issues. But I wonder if his style lends itself to debate. He may have to change some of his style to be effective tomorrow.
That's another topic that was raised here in the newsroom, is what Bernie will show up tomorrow night, and can Bernie afford for that Bernie to be on stage? And my answer to that was his style is not conducive to debate, just as Ben Carson's soft-spoken, you know, very long-winded remarks aren't conducive to debates. Neither so is Bernie Sanders, although he tends to do very well on cable news in that 3 to 4 minute one-on-one segment. And that's kind of close. But when you get down to debating, to delivering the kinds of sound bites that people want to take home with him, I'm not certain that that will be present. And he's got a demeanor about him that is a bit brusque.
Mm-hmm.
And there isn't a happy warrior in there. And we tend to nominate happy warriors, whether they're Bill Clinton or Ronald Reagan or Barack Obama. We tend to nominate and elect people who tend to let things sort of roll off. Bernie Sanders doesn't let things roll off.
No, he doesn't. And it could be that the time is ripe for things not rolling off, that people are mad about some issues.
Well, people are mad about some issues, and that's why he's filling arenas. But that same kind of anger and resentment is why Donald Trump is filling arenas.
The candidate I always thought would be more present than he appears to be right now is Martin O'Malley.
I was a bit surprised that he didn't catch fire earlier.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, and there are some places that where he is, his record as governor in Maryland hasn't necessarily served him well among some constituencies. But at the end of the day, you would expect that a former mayor, governor of Maryland would do much better, much faster. But, you know, this is this just seems to not be that kind of year, you know, where your previous public office really sort of holds weight. This is a year of name recognition, it seems like.
Mm-hmm. And the other person who you initially thought, well, he's an interesting candidate, he's an economic populist, but he's very strong on foreign affairs and probably would have some strong things to say about how we deal with this ISIS threat, is James Webb. Is he campaigning at all?
I haven't seen evidence of a campaign anywhere. Just haven't been able to suss out where he has organization in Iowa or New Hampshire or anywhere for that matter.
Yes.
I haven't seen him take a stage anywhere. I'm not certain that there is a Webb campaign that anyone can truly point to. You rarely see him even on cable news, where I'm sure the door would be wide open to him. And so you just don't see him there. And I don't know that even if he were more prevalent on the airwaves, radio or television, or even if there were, you know, some semblance of a campaign coming to growth, I'm not sure he'd be doing a lot better in the polls, at least on the Democratic side. This is the race to see who can be most progressive. Bernie Sanders has pushed Hillary Clinton further to the left than I think I ever thought I'd see her be. Jim Webb is nowhere near that end of the poll.
No, he's not.
And I'm not certain that he could ignite the kind of excitement for these Democrats as maybe, you know, Jim Webb's time was probably 1992 when Democrats were a bit more conservative in their leaning. This is the year of the progressive.
Yeah. And we'll take phone calls after I ask about the Republicans. Our phone number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. All eyes will be on the Democrats tomorrow night after two Republican debates. When you look at those who will be on stage, what do you think about their strengths and weaknesses in a debating style? Do you imagine that perhaps somebody will break through and become a front runner based on the performance tomorrow? Frank Bruni asked the question yesterday, and I thought I would ask you this, Goldie. Do you believe that the current Republican front runners, and they've been so for some time now, Donald Trump, Ben Carson, or Carly Fiorina, could be the Republican nominee?
You know, it is so tough to look at this Republican field And I'm pretty good, by the way, at picking winners. I've been pretty either really darn smart or really just really darn lucky in recent years that at this point in the game, I can generally point to the one or two people who will sort of wind up on top. On the Republican side of the table, I'm unable to do that. I'm unable, number one, to put a cap on Donald Trump, although he may or may not have hit that. I'm unable to do it. I'm unable to look at Jeb Bush and see him in the race past the next, you know, past tomorrow, save for the fact he has, you know, a bunch of money in the bank.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just, but I don't know how he does well with Southern conservatives, South Carolina, Georgia,
mm-hmm.
Kentucky. I don't know how he wins south of the Mason-Dixon line. I don't even know how he wins Florida, for God's sake. And so there is... it is very difficult for me to discern who the real front runner is, even with today's polls, when you've got more than half of registered Republicans around the country who are still undecided. And so who's winning the Republican primary right now? Well, Mr. Undecided is winning,
mm-hmm.
Beating everybody by lots of points.
And what about on the Democratic side? If you're good at picking the winners, who's the winner?
I think today, if the race were held tomorrow and Joe Biden stays home, then Hillary Clinton is still the nominee. There just is not a pathway for Bernie Sanders to get there that has opened up. You know, he had some problems. I think we talked about this earlier on with people believing whether or not he was electable. If he won the nomination, could he then win the White House? And truly, he is the greatest risk as the nominee for Republicans regaining control of the White House. The other part of that is, according to 538.com, Nate Silver's organization, he has not made up any ground in terms of non-white Democratic voters.
Right.
He's doing no better with African Americans or Hispanics. And I think the assumption is, at least according to 538, and I tend to agree with this, is that Bernie Sanders is a lot more liberal than African Americans and Hispanics are. You know, that he is, that we sort of accept that they're going to vote Democratic, but what we don't understand is how they vote when they vote Democratic, what side of the line, ideological line, they tend to fall on. And as a group, African Americans and Hispanics report higher church attendance than any other demographic in the country.
Mm-hmm.
African American women vote at a higher pace than any other demographic in the country, but they're also the biggest churchgoers. And so there is a strong conservative vein running through both communities, and I think that is a bit of a wall for Bernie Sanders to get over. Never mind all of the issues with Black Lives Matter and social justice and his civil rights history,
yes,
and legacy in this country. Never mind any of those things. It's where he stands up on the issues today.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. We're going to welcome phone calls. Goldie Taylor is our guest for all things political for this Monday. She's an editor at large for the Daily Beast. She was a political analyst and on-air contributor at MSNBC, focusing on public policy issues, and she's been an award-winning journalist for some 25 years. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. We have one line open for you right now if you would like to take it. It is yours. Looking at the Republican debate, looking at the front runners in the, Democratic debate, which is tomorrow night. There have been so many Republican debates, I forgot there's a Democratic debate. It's tomorrow, and we'll analyze it on Wednesday on this program. And we have a lot of other issues to discuss as well as we move along this hour. But we'll be with you and your thoughts in just a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All things political this hour. Let's go to phone calls, starting with Phil in Hebron, Illinois. Hi, Phil.
Hey, good afternoon, Kathleen. I noted that you referenced a couple of articles in the New York Times, and I read it yesterday, too. And it was a real good article back in Opinions. It was a husband and wife truck driving team, and I deal with truck drivers all day in my industry that I deal with. And they just their little thing was, we drive across the country. We talk to a lot of people. We go to Caterpillar, we go to Coca-Cola, we go to M&M, we go to Iowa Beef Packers. Nobody's grinning ear to ear. And the guy said, the guys that I talk to say, I'm driving the 48 contiguous states. I'm still looking for the recovery. I'm looking for it. And the week before, the New York Times had an article on Ben Bernanke's new book, and he was quoted in the book saying it really hurts him when he drives down the street and sees a bumper sticker that says, "Where's my recovery?" think it's both the same thing and think a politician should get in the cab of a semi and talk to the guys I talk to every day.
Yeah, does that make Phil one of the candidates more attractive because he or she is focusing on where's the recovery?
Well, what was interesting, these two said, who are you voting for? And he said, anybody who's not a politician. I kind of feel the same way.
Interesting.
If they're already in, let's try somebody else, because who we got in, they ain't doing it.
Mm-hmm.
The guy said, I drive all day, and I don't see anybody that says I'm making too much money.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. Goldie.
I have to agree with him. I would like nothing better than to see some of these candidates get in a cab with one of those trucks, you know, and ride through a few states and just, you know, close your mouth and open your ears.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to what some of these working class people have to say out here. I don't know anybody who believes they're making too much money, of course, but, you know, are there economic indicators out there that say that we're in the midst, you know, of a, you know, better than expected recovery? Sure, there are indicators out there, but I hear, as your caller said, far too many people saying they're not feeling it at their house. We certainly haven't felt it at ours.
No.
That they aren't feeling it in their homes, and they're not feeling it in their lives and in their schools and in their communities, and I think that's what really matters. There is a huge sentiment out there that agrees exactly with the caller. Anybody but who's in there now. To have Washington in your bio seems to be a very bad idea. If you look at the GOP frontrunners, who's ahead now?
Mm-hmm.
The top several folks, none of them are Washington insiders. Donald Trump, Ben Carson, Carly Fiorina, none of them are Washington insiders. In fact, the one guy who had, you know, who was also a Washington outsider, but a sitting governor who had the backing of the Koch brothers, no less, Scott Walker,
right?
Dropped out of the race.
Yeah, absolutely.
Could not get enough support, and so governing seems not to be a banner of experience, mm-hmm. at least on the Republican side of the water. You don't have that same dynamic playing out, even though you hear it, and they don't have a candidate to get behind who is necessarily an outsider, even though you hear the same kind of pushback with anybody, you know, let's throw the rascals out kind
yeah.
of mentality.
And Goldie, there was this other story which really stopped me in my tracks yesterday. Half the cash for the presidential race has come from only half the cash, 158 families in this country. Isn't that astounding?
I'm not surprised in the least. Disappointing. Lots of anguish, maddening, but not surprised in the least. Number one, given the concentration of wealth in this country, the notion that under 200 families had that kind of largesse to give is not surprising to me. But then again, on the other side of this thing, given how Washington really works, that it matter that votes do matter in terms of who we send to Washington, but once they're there and who keeps them there, the work of lobbyists, the work of special interest groups, the work of PACs, are influencing who takes the seats and what legislation, how legislation flows, that these families have financial interest. Some of them have some ideological interest in what happens in Washington, but many of them have a strict financial interest in what happens in Washington. And so they've got the wherewithal, and they're making their bucks be heard. But you're hearing some other candidates, like Bernie Sanders, saying, I don't want their money.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, I want the donations of the everyman, of the everywoman, that I want to go to Washington for you. You hear a lot about campaign finance reform from a lot of different folks, but nobody really wants to do it. They'd like to continue focusing on those, you know, 158 families because, you know, they think that that's their constituency.
Yeah. Mm. Phil, thanks for your call. John in Milwaukee. Hi.
Well, Kathleen, this special podium for Mr. Biden sounds intriguing. It sounds like we're going to have a canopy and a chair and maybe some angels and candlesticks just waiting for Joe to show up. The night of the debate. And really, for those of us in organized labor, given the fact that he is supporting TPP, the Pacific Rim Treaty, none of the Democrats are intriguing at all, and the Republicans are certainly not going to get any strong support from organized labor. So here we sit with another election where the income gap is just going to get greater and the power of organized labor is going to get diminished even more.
Goldie.
You know, I think he makes a serious point there that the power of organized labor, election over election over election, has begun to diminish somewhat, and that's unfortunate. I think that collective bargaining is still a very strong value, something that should be strongly valued in this country, and support for unions certainly. You know, I think that there are some people who have some emotional tie to, we call him Uncle Joe, for all the great loss and the crises that he's weathered through his life. I think there's an American story there that people have sort of latched onto. But there are some real differences on policy. His support for TPP, I think Hillary Clinton's campaign, there were some murmurs that they would be bringing up the Anita Hill hearings. They would be going back to his votes on the crime bill, the 94 crime bill. I think there are some rumblings that, you know, Joe Biden hadn't always been Joe Biden. Joe Biden's had a very long career in Washington, and there are some places, some valid points of differences for Democrats. Certainly Republicans are more conservative than they ever were, I guess, over the last 25 to 30 years. But Democrats are also more liberal than they were over the last 25 to 30 years. And Joe Biden was once on the other end of that spectrum. So I do think there's going to be, this won't be an easy ride for him. And while you know, the folks that seen him would love to have him on that podium, I don't think he'll be there.
Yeah, I don't either. John, thanks for the call. Pat in Richland, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. Great show, ladies. With the Speaker of the House job becoming so hard to fill, you know, nobody just simply wants to do it because the Tea Party Republicans have made it such a repulsive job. What do you think the chances are that it's going to have to go to an undocumented immigrant because nobody else will do the job?
That would make a headline for sure.
Yes, it would. Well, Paul Ryan, Wisconsin's Paul Ryan, they're begging him to take the job. It sounds like he doesn't want it, but maybe he will. What do you think, Goldie?
You know, I they've got a real problem right now, and that's the difficulty with Republicans as of late, is they know what they don't want, they just can't figure out what they do want. And so for many, many months, they have wanted Boehner to pack it in and go home. But they did not have an alternative who was electable in a speaker. I'm not all that sure that Paul Ryan would have an easy road to hoe as speaker. Some of the far right-wing conservatives don't trust him, frankly. They think that his stance on immigration and other issues, were a sellout of Republican principles. And so they're not all that interested. Good people over at Red State aren't all that interested in seeing Paul Ryan be Speaker of the House. And so he really is their best unifying choice. But Republicans on the far right end of the party aren't really interested in unifying. They're interested in, you know, having their way, and that is a real, real issue. The difficulty here is, you don't have an alternative to him. And I think that's, I think this is one of the reasons why he's not put his hat into the race, is that he doesn't want to see, you know, some of the far right wing come for him publicly and tear the party further apart.
Right. Thank you very much, Pat, for your call. We have lines open if you want to join our All Things Political conversation. And here's how you do so, 800-486-8655. Goldie Taylor is our guest. She's editor-at-large now for The Daily Beast. We're doing a little preview of tomorrow's Democratic debate, the first one. There are going to be five people on stage. We've only really heard much about two, but maybe you're supporting one of the other three other than Clinton or Sanders and would like to make a case for how we should watch them carefully tomorrow night. Also looking at the continuing front runners in the Republican race, Paul Ryan, Republicans just really feeling he's the only guy who can bring together the very conservative faction in the Republican Party and the more moderate faction, but he doesn't seem to be thrilled to take on the job. We'll be looking at the former staffer on the House Benghazi Committee, who over the weekend said that the investigation was a partisan attack on Hillary Clinton. She immediately said, "This is explosive." We'll talk about that. And welcome you to the conversation, 800-486-8655. Also, Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show, where Jim writes, how do you explain, Goldie, the GOP's success in getting middle and working class people to vote against their interests? It was dramatically displayed when Jeb Bush's prime critique of Trump's tax plan was that it weighs heavily on the wealthy.
It's inexplicable, isn't it, really? But that has been going on for quite a while in this country. Populism sells among working poor people. And when that fails, you use fear. You use fear of people, say, seizing our guns. You use things like social wedge social issues like abortion. You take their eye off of economic issues, and you push them to hotbed wedge social issues. And if you keep them tied up there, you can keep them sort of roped into your party line. And so, I think that's really unfortunate, really, about both parties. Both parties engage in some form of it. But that's really how they do it. They divert them to, other issues on which they can evoke a little fear.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Clinton and the emails and the Benghazi committee for a moment. The president was on 60 Minutes yesterday saying that her use of a private email server was a mistake. It hadn't endangered national security, he said. And he said it's been ginned up into a political attack by Republicans. Then you had this staffer, former staffer for, I didn't realize this had been going on for 17 months, the Benghazi investigation, saying that really this is just became very political just to get her. And then it changed from a focus on Benghazi and what happened there to the email controversy. She's going to testify fairly soon, isn't she, before that committee?
She does testify very soon before that committee, but I have to tell you that it has been 17 months and nearly $5 million, and they've had to shut down, as I understand it, other investigations, other committees, have sort of had to narrow their focus because they were diverting resources to this committee. I have to agree when that Benghazi deserved a strong look. Any time that we have assets attacked, foreign assets attacked overseas, and we have American lives lost, that deserves an inquiry because we need to get better. Wow, this is about saving lives going forward and being answerable, accountable to the families of those people who were lost.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's important. And so I would not have been opposed to opening a Benghazi committee, but to keep it going for this long and then to move it to an email question is certainly something that I find is frankly distasteful. And then to see a former staffer come out, and we don't know if the staffer is an angel or a toe of the hun. We don't know what the motives are. But if the story holds up to be true, that we have spent all of this money as a political gambit to keep Hillary Clinton's poll numbers down, as McCarthy's appear to have said,
mm-hmm.
Then that's a real problem. And I think even I would expect more of Trey Gowdy on that account. And so I think we're going to hear more about what has happened in that committee over the coming days as the story continues to pick up steam. But, I'm of the mind that, we understand now what happened at Benghazi. We need to issue a final report on how we get better and improve security at our embassies and other facilities around the world, and then we need to shut it down.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of her email, I don't know that the American people care, quite frankly. Classified material was not passed through it. I think there were some things that were deemed classified after they were passed through, but I don't think there was, and anything that she sent over that email to the State Department is already on State Department service and available to them. Colin Powell also used a personal email address while Secretary of State. I think it's much ado about nothing. I think it's something that fills the airwaves. I think we've written about it quite a bit here at the Daily Beast, and I think some of my colleagues here even disagree with me on this.
Hmm.
So maybe there is some room for disagreement, but it ladders up to another story. And I think this is what keeps it alive, and that is the credibility of the Clintons.
Right.
That people want to believe that the Clintons don't know how to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And if you know, if you believe that, then this story fits nicely into that narrative. Mm-hmm.
And she hasn't, though, handled this whole story very well, has she? She's been, you know, kind of flip about it and challenging mm-hmm. reporters, and she's just been all over the place with it, which can tend to keep a story alive, too, unless
she
you put
done,
it to rest sometimes.
She has done yeoman's work in keeping the story alive. But if you look back on other Clinton controversies since they landed in Washington, they've never handled crisis well.
Right.
They've never managed crises in a way that would put them to bed so that, you know, we could move on, whether they were innocent or not so innocent in any given circumstance. That, you know, Bill Clinton's answer to depends on what the meaning of is, was the absolute worst thing to say. And did more to keep the story alive, I think,
yes.
really, than anything
yes.
else. And so I do think that this story could have been tamped down a lot earlier, and I do think that you know, Mrs. Clinton and her team are partly culpable for the story still being alive.
Guy in Milwaukee, hello.
Enjoying the show, and a question for the guest. At the top of the show, she mentioned that Bernie Sanders hasn't really got any additional traction with African-American or Hispanic communities, and I'm wondering, what are the things that they're not hearing that they need to hear from him, or is it just his kind of East Coast personality that just doesn't vibe with them, or what is it?
You know, I think it's a couple of things, and first of all, it's an excellent question. First of all, I think Bernie Sanders has got to do the work of going out to those communities, spending time there. Some people, you know, kind of write it off as a listening tour, but he's got to sort of understand some of these issues through their cultural lens. And so when Bernie Sanders talks about, you know, economic parity in this country, opening up economic opportunities for people, you know, he extends that and then says, you know, that can really answer some of our racial issues. Well, African Americans and Hispanics don't believe that. And so they tend to believe Bernie Sanders less, that he's going to be the kind of guy who's going to speak to, you know, some of these issues of racial inequality more directly. And so he's got to go out and really begin to have conversations in those communities. He's done great work at hiring a more diverse staff. His national press secretary, Simone Sanders, no relation, happens to be an African-American woman who comes from, you know, a very activist tradition. Mm. She's a great part of that. But he's got to begin to go out and make those connections, and realizing that Hillary Clinton has had these connections since Arkansas.
Right.
That he's got brand new connections to make, that he was, you know, he is senator in Vermont, which is, I believe, 92% to 94% white.
Mm-hmm.
He's never had to, you know, represent a diverse constituency, and now he's telling America that he can. And so in order to do that, he's got to forge greater connections. So that's one part of this thing. The other part of this thing, and I think the caller hit the nail on the head, that it is demeanor, that it is kind of that northeasternly Vermont demeanor that plays really well in places like Iowa and places like New Hampshire, but not play so well in South Carolina, where 56% of the Democratic primary happens to be African American.
Really, 56%?
56%.
Wow.
And it's like that in several other states, Georgia being one of them, where they represent more than half of the Democratic primary. Just African Americans, not including Hispanics. Add voting Hispanics in, and you've got a different ball game altogether. And so, you know, part of this is, you know, yes, he's got to go out and make the outreach directly, and he's got to pick some of the right ambassadors. I don't know that Cornel West is going to help him in that regard. He can be quite inflammatory, but
yes.
He needs to get himself a great band of surrogates to say, hey, Bernie's our man, and he's okay. He's worth listening to. And worth hearing. He'll hear you. So I think that's part of it. But the other part of it, I think, is that this is not work that Bernie Sanders has had to do, and that he is comes off sometimes in some of these events. I met him at Netroots back in July, came off as aloof and disconnected and unconcerned in some ways, angry about the Black Lives Matter protesters in front of him, when that is the very tradition that he came from, that he came from an activist tradition, and he seemed resentful that he was being confronted by activists.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's some, I think your caller is right. There are two pieces to this. One, Bernie Sanders' demeanor and how he approaches these things. And two, a lack of connection directly with those communities.
Thanks, Guy, for the call. All Things Political is what you're listening to here on the Ideas Network. And our guest is an award-winning journalist, Goldie Taylor. She is now editor-at-large at The Daily Beast. She's been in the business for 25 years, and we're talking about politics this hour. We always do on Mondays. We'll take more phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Spike in Milwaukee. Thanks for waiting, Spike. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Great show today. Really good listening. And before I ask my question, I just want to say your guest was right on the head with what has to be done by Bernie Sanders in order to reach the minority community. I'm a retired broadcast and print reporter, and I'm seeing what she's seeing. My question, though, is kind of two-pronged. Number one, what is up with Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the Democratic National Committee? Only 5 debates scheduled. '08, there were, 20-some? In '04, there were 19, 20-some. What is she afraid of? And then number two, what is your guest take on the forum today, I think it is, that some of the Democratic and Republican candidates are going to take part in, and I'm not sure exactly where it is.
I don't know exactly where that one is today.
I don't either.
I had not heard about it.
I saw something about it on the overnight news last night.
Huh. Let me take a quick look in here, Democratic. And while I'm looking, I can answer your question about Debbie Wasserman Schultz. And I can say, in a word, it's an atrocity. I think it's wrong that when you, I like more voices at the table, not fewer.
Mm-hmm.
And any time that you've got, this kind of calendar, I think it can only, and her job is to really serve voters, not candidates. And so to put these candidates on stage with a rigorous test on the issues, I think is important. And I think to limit the number of debates, I find something morally reprehensible about that. I'm sorry to say that out loud. and it doesn't matter to me whether or not it would make it helps one candidate or another to have more. If it helps Martin O'Malley to have more, I'm completely agnostic about that.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm not agnostic about is the benefit to voters to be able to see their candidates as many times as possible on as many different issues as possible. I'm not agnostic about that. I do think that this was built, constructed in a way that only helps a candidate like Hillary Clinton.
Well, the other thing is that it's drawing, at least the Republicans have been drawing pretty large numbers, right? We're watching these debates.
Huge numbers. Absolutely. Huge numbers. They have been. And they don't, frankly, expect the numbers for the CNN debate tomorrow night to be nearly as high as you saw when Trump and Carson and Fiorina and others took the field just a few weeks ago. They don't expect that to be the case. But I don't know that that bothers me or should be a determining factor for me in regard to how many debates we ought to have.
Mm-hmm.
I think if two or more are assembled, Campbell, I think if two or more are assembled in the room, the candidates have a duty to show up.
Yeah. So did you find this forum, Goldie, or not?
I have not found this forum.
Spike, we don't know what it is.
I wish I could remember where it was, but as I said, I saw it on one of the overnight newscasts.
Yeah.
I said, that's interesting. Candidates from both parties getting together and going at it during a primary season. I love it myself.
Yeah, I think it'd be great. Yeah. All right. Well, KP is looking, too, in case we find something. Thanks, Spike, very much for your call. Bob in Minneapolis. Hi.
Well, good afternoon, Kathleen. I'm enjoying your show. I'm driving through Wisconsin. I am wondering if the Republicans are losing sight of what the real objective is. The objective is to win the presidential election, not to win not the nomination. And the kinds of candidates like Trump and our traditional friends, et cetera, because there's no way that they are going to win the presidential election. The American people are a little bit more clever than that. So a person like John Kasich from Ohio, who is one of the middle of the voters, certainly seems like the only one that can really win the election. Bush might be able to, but Kasich certainly could. And I just wondered what the reactions for that.
Okay, thanks, Bob. Goldie.
Republicans would tell you this, that they've gone with mainstream. They went with John McCain. They'll tell you that they went with Mitt Romney, who had been, Republican governor in a blue state. That they went with, people that they thought, might be able to capture a broader swath of the vote. And they lost, they'll tell you. They'll tell you that if they lost, their explanation as to why they lost, despite the Republican autopsy report done by the RNC, they'll tell you that they lost because they folded on Republican principles, and they truly believe that. That they truly do believe that the country is not a center country, but a center-right country. That we are much more conservative than our politics seem to suggest. They're wrong about that, you'll note. But they truly do believe that there is a conservative revival coming, and that they need to find the right candidate who will speak to the things that they are angry about, fearful about. They haven't said it this year, but it really is take our country back. That mood is very much out there. That's what's driving the want for an outsider, like, for instance, a Ben Carson, who people see as a counterpoint to Barack Obama. He happens to be African-American, but he's the kind of American story that Republicans would rather tell than Barack Obama. They believe that he is the more credible. As Rupert Murdoch said, he'd be the first real black president. And so there is a real feeling among Republicans that this country is more conservative than it is, and that they simply need to get their message about what's really happening out there, and that they're going to win national elections. The reality is the only reason why they're holding on to the House of Representatives today is because of gerrymandered districts going back to reapportionment. The reality is that without gerrymandering, then the Republicans would be no more powerful than your local PTA.
Hmm. Bob, thanks for the call. Let's go to Kenneth in Janesville. Hi.
Hello. Hillary Clinton has displayed is inability to make a decision, a correct decision, and nobody is talking about that. I mean, isn't that why we elect the president?
What decisions concern you, or
well,
lack of decisions?
Everything that has turned out badly for her. Nobody seems to be talking about that. I mean, using a personal computer was a bad decision. All the other things she's done, I mean, she's pulled the wrong lever. And do you want somebody like that as president?
No. Okay. All right. Thanks, Kenneth. Goldie.
Who can say? I mean, Hillary Clinton certainly had to know or had to have the door open that she would be running for president in 2016 when they plugged in a personal server. And I'm not at all sure who would have given that kind of counsel to someone who was likely going to be running for president at some point, or at least leave the door open to running at some point in her future in her life. And so that would concern me. But I am more concerned about, and I think the caller is right, about how long it takes a decision to come out of Clinton land.
Mm-hmm.
On this trade deal, how long did it take her to come down to say, to speak her position, Keystone Pipeline?
Mm-hmm.
There are many, many places. There's still, even though she gave a public address back in April about mass incarceration and the school-to-prison pipeline, she's met since then with people like DeRay McKesson from Campaign Zero, still has not put out a comprehensive platform around policing in America, mass incarceration, school-to-prison pipeline, all of those other kinds of issues. And it feels to me that it's going through the sausage grinder. Well, she tends to grind sausage a lot longer than other people.
Yeah, she does. Goldie, we're out of time. And we want to, KP has found this place. It's the No Labels Problem Solvers Convention. They have 8 candidates, 2,000 activists, mostly from New Hampshire. They are at the Expo Center today to hear 8 presidential candidates, 5 of them live, stress the need for bipartisanship in the political debate and, more importantly, in Washington. So we'll follow that. Thank you very much for being with us. It was great.
Thank you for having me.
Our guest, Goldie Taylor, who's editor-at-large for The Daily Beast. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this good hour. And thanks to KP Whaley for doing on-air production. And thanks for all your great calls.